This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Well, farmers markets are beginning to open for the season here in the Midwest. These markets have had a tremendous impact on the produce carried by supermarkets. With the boom in farmers markets, the number of produce items found at the grocery store doubled, as did our spending on fruits and vegetables. So much variety in our supermarkets, available 24/7, 365 days a year. But what about flavor? Sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not. This afternoon in this portion of the program, we're going to talk about how the fruits and vegetables we eat are grown, marketed, and sold. We'll also talk about flavor, and we'll talk about how to select fruits and vegetables, how to store them, and how to prepare them. Our guest is journalist and cook Russ Parsons. He's covered food and agriculture for over 20 years. His new book is How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. The book reports on plant designers, farming methods, and the return of the small family farm. It's a guide organized by season to common fruits and vegetables and how to select them, store them, and prepare them. There are recipes for appetizers and first courses, soups, main dishes, side dishes, and condiments, breakfasts, and desserts. Listeners, I look forward to hearing your questions and comments for our guest, Russ Parsons. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. Russ Parsons is the food and wine columnist for the Los Angeles Times. He's also the author of the best-selling and award-winning How to Read a French Fry. That book and the new book, How to Pick a Peach, are published by Houghton Mifflin. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Russ Parsons, thanks. Welcome.
Celeste, it's wonderful to have you, for you to have me on. It's not wonderful for you to be here because you're not here. We're on the radio.
Yeah, we're on the radio. Well, you're in California, and we're here in Illinois, and big difference in what grows here and what grows there.
Well, yeah, there is, and unfortunately, we've kind of gotten to this point now where more than half of all of the fresh fruits and vegetables that are grown in the United States are grown in California, and I think that the next leading state is Florida with about 10%. So there's a huge whether you like it or not, and whether you know it or not, you're probably eating a lot of California fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, well, it's a kind of a good news bad news deal, really, because the good news is we get to eat wonderful fruits from California. I mean, there are lots of good things that come from California, and when they get here, they taste very good. On the other hand, there are things that come from far away, and when they get here, they're not very good.
Well, that's true. It's all about compromise. Really ripe fruits and really ripe vegetables, they just don't travel well. They're fragile, and so when you pick stuff, if you pick things at exactly the peak, by the time it got to Illinois, it would be fruit jam.
Yeah.
Or it would be, everything would be wilted. And so they pick a little earlier, they do different kinds of compromises, and unfortunately those compromises often affect the flavor.
Yeah. They have done an awful lot, though, in terms of packaging.
Yes.
To keep things fresher.
Absolutely. And I don't want to sound like one of those Californians. You know, the eat local, eat seasonal, kind of the dogma,
the religion
of California.
Yeah, easy for you guys to say.
It's easy for us to say, and I'm well aware of that. My editor on the book lives in Vermont, and believe me, I heard a lot about the produce situation in Vermont, which probably makes Illinois look like the Garden State when it comes to growing fruits and vegetables. But the main thing that I think people need to understand is that there are these compromises that are made. And so when you understand that, then you can make the choices. When the farmers markets are kicking up in the Midwest, you're always going to, the strawberries there are always going to be better than the strawberries that come from California, almost always going to be, because they can be picked later. They can be picked at full ripeness. The ones from California, if they picked them at the same stage of ripeness, by the time they got to you, they'd be a mess.
Yeah, yeah. And if we can go out and pick them now at You Pick Farms, that's really great.
Yeah, you know, there's all different kinds of there's all different kinds of ways of getting stuff now that there didn't used to be. You Picks are huge. I think in the Midwest, the community supported agriculture is catching on,
mm-hmm.
where you kind of subscribe with a farmer and you agree to pay him X amount for a year, and every week you get a box of produce that he's grown for you. Farmers markets, of course, and even as you said in the opening, there are farmers market quality. There's farmers market quality produce that's even starting to show up at supermarkets. So it's not all, you know, it's certainly not all gloom and doom.
Yeah, how was it that farmers markets really began to boom, to spring up all over the country?
Well, I think what happened was there were a couple things that happened. First of all, there was kind of the gourmeting of America when, you know, back in St. Julia, when people started paying attention to food, they started wanting more variety, and then they started wanting odder things. You know, I mean, I can remember, when I started cooking 25 years ago, I would have to every year I would make a deal with my produce guy to buy a box of red bell peppers when they came in, because they were only in for like a couple of weeks, and so. Mm-hmm. I would go and pick them up, and one weekend I'd grill, roast them on the grill, and freeze them so that I had them for the rest of the year. Well, I mean, that sounds like fun. It sounds funny now. It's almost like a horse and buggy kind of story. We never think about that,
yeah.
Being in that situation. And so, in looking for that kind of variety, lots of small farmers started. There was more money to be made in selling niche items, so they started going to that. Now, there was a funny thing in California. Until 1977, it was illegal to have a farmer's market. All fruits and vegetables that were sold had to meet commercial packing and shipping requirements, one of which was that it had to go through a vegetable distributor. But when they changed that law, 78, there were something like seven, and I know in Southern California alone, there's 95 farmers markets, and the same thing has happened all over the United States, and it's just because people are looking for flavor. You know, they're looking for that kind of that great fruit and great vegetable flavor that you can't get with stuff that has been trucked in. I mean, that may be the stuff that we use as our staples. It may be the stuff that we use that we live on. But when you want something that's really special, you go to the farmer's market.
One of the things that I have found remarkable in recent years, and you write about this in How to Pick a Peach, is the tomato, the story of the tomato. And I'm going to have you talk about that in just a moment. But first, I've got to bring folks up to date on some weather information. This is WILL AM and FM Urbana. The National Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for northern Christian County and southeastern Sangamon County in central Illinois until 1:45 Central Time. At 1:14 Central Time, National Weather Service Doppler radar indicated a severe thunderstorm capable of producing penny-size hail and damaging winds in excess of 60 miles per hour. This storm was located near Pawnee, or about 10 miles northeast of Verdon, and was moving east at 40 miles per hour. Repeating, a severe thunderstorm warning for northern Christian County and southeastern Sangamon County until 1:45 this afternoon. Okay. Now we're back with Russ Parsons here on the AM side. The tomato, that is one remarkable story. You know, it wasn't all that long ago. If you wanted a good tomato, you just said, I'm waiting till July.
And picking it out of my backyard.
Yeah. And now we do. There are some decent choices at the supermarket.
The tomatoes actually is kind of a success story, a remarkable success story, because it wasn't so long ago that the tomato was the one thing that everybody focused on when they talked about what had gone wrong with produce and with agriculture. You know, because it was impossible to. Everybody remembered the flavor of a great tomato, and the people who actually grew them remember, you know, still had it. But it was what you found in the grocery store was just, you know, it was something that looked tomato-ish, but it wasn't a tomato. Again, partly through the farmers' markets, people started finding access to it. And the other thing was that there would be three different kinds of tomatoes. That was all the choices you had. You know, there'd be a vine ripe, or what they called vine ripe. There'd be the mature green, which is kind of the rock hard slicer, and there might be cherry tomatoes. But you know, capitalism works in mysterious ways, and when people started being offered alternatives, they really jumped for it. And the thing that was really remarkable about the first alternatives were where they came from, because it wasn't from Mexico, or it wasn't from California, it wasn't kind of the usual suspects. It was from Holland, because they have really extensive greenhouses there. And so they started growing different varieties of tomatoes that weren't available here. And when they first started importing them, even though they were very, very pricey, people just went nuts for it. And then the greenhouses moved to Canada, because then they didn't have to worry about cross-oceanic shipping. And so you started getting those, you know, tomatoes that are sold on the vine. And I'm not convinced that those tomatoes taste better, but they sure smell better. You know, so much of the tomato smell is locked up in that vine. And you know, when you pull it off and you really get the tomato. And now, you know, at peak time, in the summertime, some produce sections, they'll have 25 or 26 different kinds of tomatoes. Now, all of them are not going to be good. And quite frankly, only probably a couple of them are going to have anything that's close to that backyard tomato flavor. But they're much, much better than they had been before. And, you know, they've got those little grape tomatoes now that started out coming out of Florida. And those are really terrific. Those can be pretty terrific tomatoes. They're much sweeter than regular tomatoes, and they've got kind of a nice thick skin. They're about the size of a cherry tomato, except they're a little bit more oblong. They've got a great pop when you eat them, and really terrific flavor.
Yeah. I was dying for a tomato, and to put, and I, you know, I wanted it on a hamburger.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a chance, and I bought something that's a tomato on the vine, a TOV,
mm-hmm.
and it's about the size of a golf ball, maybe
right.
A little bit bigger, and that's pretty good.
Was it a good flavor?
Yeah.
Well, that's terrific. You know, another thing that's happening now is heirloom tomatoes are showing up in supermarkets. And that used to be, I mean, that's astonishing to me, because I can remember, oh, 5 or 8 years ago when I was growing, when I had a backyard garden, and there was this tomato cult where we'd get together and swap seeds for these old varieties that nobody grew anymore.
Uh-huh.
And now they're at the grocery store. And that's really a remarkably quick transition from cult item to mainstream appeal. And, you know, the thing that people need to remember is that farming isn't manufacturing. And when you talk about something like a tomato, you know, it may be a Brandywine, and a well-grown Brandywine is a really terrific tomato. But if it's not a Brandywine that's not carefully grown, isn't going to be all that much better than a regular old supermarket tomato. So you still need to use your senses and trust your smell and your sense of sight and touch.
Yeah. Speaking of that, that's really how to pick a peach, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, with all different kinds of fruits and vegetables, there are these little tips that if you understand them and you pay attention, you know, you engage in kind of the shopping process, you're going to do a heck of a lot better than if you just go in and just pick stuff off of the shelf. You know, with tomatoes, for example, there's a give to them. There's the smell of them. There's the color. The quality of the color, you know, it should be really deep and vibrant, not pale. And there's tips like that for all different kinds of fruits and vegetables.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is journalist Russ Parsons. His latest book, How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. Our guest is the food and wine columnist for the Los Angeles Times, and he has been covering food and agriculture now for for over 20 years. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us with questions, comments. Give us a phone call this afternoon, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL, and locally in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Well, at this point here in Illinois, in the Midwest, should we just pass up the peaches at the supermarket and wait? Or can you find a good peach?
Well, you know, I think there's a value in waiting.
Mm-hmm.
In the first place, when people talk, especially Californians, I'm afraid, when we talk the whole seasonal local thing, it begins to sound prescriptive. You know, it's like, this is something that you ought to do because it's good for you, or this is something that you ought to do because it's good for the planet, or, you know, any of these things. But the simple thing is that when you buy things that are at the peak of their season, that's when they have the best quality, and that's also when they have when they're the cheapest. And that's a pretty unbeatable combination. So if the short answer is, yeah, I'd wait. I mean, even in California now, the peaches aren't at their... We're still at least 3 weeks from kind of the kickoff of great peach season. And peaches are one of those fruits. Like, a great peach is like a great tomato. You know, it's got other things can be really delicious and they can be really sweet, but a great peach or a great tomato has that. They're foods that have the power to move you, you know.
Yeah.
Like, oh, my goodness gracious, yeah. What is that? That's a terrific peach. And to get peaches like that, you're really probably going to have to go to farmers markets, because a peach that's hung on the tree long enough to be a great peach, you can get good peaches from California. But to get a great peach, I think it's going to have to come from a local farmer who can get it from the tree to the market in one day, and, you know, without it going through a whole series of handling and without
right.
it having to be trucked and all of those other things that are so damaging to fragile fruit.
Yeah. And I've got to interrupt here and make another weather announcement.
Well, you guys are in for it, aren't you?
Yeah, we are. Active day is how we phrase it here in the Midwest, active weather day. So let's hold on here. We're going to resume our conversation with Russ Parsons in just a moment. This is WILL AM and FM. The National Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for northwestern DeWitt County and northern Logan County in central Illinois until 2:15. At 1:24, National Weather Service Doppler radar indicated a severe thunderstorm. This storm was located near Lincoln and was moving northeast at 20 miles per hour. Locations impacted include Beeson, Atlanta, Waynesville, and Wapella. Repeating, a severe thunderstorm warning for northwestern DeWitt and northern Logan County in central Illinois until 2:15. And we're back with Russ Parsons. Sorry for the interruptions, but there's not much we can do.
Hey, I lived in West Texas. I know what the weather's like.
Yeah, and that's one of the cool things about community-supported agriculture, you know, as you're kind of in there with the farmer. And maybe you would talk a little bit about farmers. You dedicate the book to farmers.
I think, again, I think for most of us, we live so far from where our food is grown, from where the fruits and vegetables are grown. Even in California, I mean, if it's not a physical distance, it's at least a mental distance. Fruits and vegetables come from the supermarket, and they're lined up, and they look like somebody built them. You know, they're manufactured items, and I think we forget that farming is a real talent. It's a craft. Good farming is, and that those people need to be appreciated. I mean, the way I look at it as a cook is, if I start with good ingredients, my job is so much easier. And so, you know, I'm very, very thankful to farmers who grow good ingredients, so I don't have to work quite so hard when I get into the kitchen.
Yeah, that is one thing I will compliment you on. One of the things I would compliment you on with this book is that the recipes, they rely on quality ingredients, and then they're very simple and straightforward, but I can't wait to try some of them.
Well, thank you. I'm not a Thomas Keller I'm not a great technical cook. I'm a home cook, and for me, any extra step that I add to a recipe, there's got to be a payoff in flavor. It's kind of that, the shortest distance between two points is a straight line, and so what I want is something that tastes great, and I wanted to be able to do it in the simplest way possible.
Yeah. Well, one of the seasonal items available both at the supermarket now here and at our just open farmer's market is asparagus. And there are a couple of wonderful asparagus recipes. They're very simple. Asparagus mimosa, tell us about that. And you say that's a recipe that has largely been forgotten.
Yeah, sauce mimosa is one of those old-time French things that kind of fell out of fashion, I guess. And wrongly so, because it's really delicious. And it sounds fancy, asparagus mimosa. What it is, basically, is steamed or blanched asparagus. And then it's a kind of vinaigrette that you also make with, or to which you add chopped hard-boiled eggs. And that kind of the combination of the fresh herbs and the hard-cooked eggs, they just add another depth of flavor. And they're really beautiful. You've got the dark green asparagus and the orange yolk and the white and the green. Without any effort, it makes a really a beautiful plate.
And what holds the sauce together?
It's just a vinaigrette.
Just a vinaigrette.
Yeah, you just whisk it together, and it's just like making a regular old salad dressing.
Simple and delicious.
Nothing fancy to it.
Yeah. And then wrapped in crisp prosciutto, that's something that's unbeatable.
That's another one of those, people look at the recipe, and it's literally two ingredients, or maybe three. You oil it with a little bit of olive oil first. But it's basically just a good asparagus, good prosciutto. You wrap this prosciutto around the asparagus, and then you bake it in a 450-degree oven. And you let it sit for like 5 minutes in there before you start shaking it. And at the end of it, what you get, the asparagus kind of roasts. Roasted asparagus is good anyways, because the roasting really concentrates the flavor. But the prosciutto crisps at the same time. And so there's this great combination of the kind of the tenderness of the asparagus and the crispness of the prosciutto and the saltiness of the ham and the green vegetable. It's really, and it takes 15 minutes, and I tell you, anybody can do it. It's really, really easy.
Yeah. Now, when we buy asparagus, what should we look for?
Well, there's three things with asparagus to pay attention to. And the first thing is that check the base. That cut part of the base, nick it with your thumb. It should be moist. And in fact, in really good stores, what they'll do is they'll sell asparagus standing up on like a wet pad or in a shallow pan of water, because asparagus loses moisture so quickly. Then look at the tips. They should be really tightly furled, because asparagus is a kind of fern. And if you've ever seen an asparagus field, when it's out of season, it looks like this vast field of ferns. All those little bumps on the tip open out into branches. Finally, look at the middle. There shouldn't be any wrinkles. Remember that asparagus does lose moisture really quickly, so any sign of wilting is bad. Those are the ones you want to pass up. And as far as choosing between, there's a lot of passionate discussion, shall we say, about whether to buy, people like fat asparagus or thin asparagus, and they actually come from the same plant.
Yeah.
The fat asparagus usually comes from the center of the plant, where the roots have the most vigor, and the thin asparagus usually comes from the outer rim of the plant, where the vigor is a little less. And I use the fat asparagus if I'm serving it by itself. Like if I'm going to make the asparagus with a sauce mimosa, or even in my house, we usually do it even more simple, more simply, just blanch the asparagus and dress it in a vinaigrette while it's still warm, and then serve it at room temperature. And I'll make big platters of that, and people just go crazy because good asparagus is so delicious.
Yeah.
But with thin asparagus, you don't need to peel it, because the skin isn't, or the peel isn't fibrous enough. And it's really good to use as an ingredient. So if you're going to make a risotto, for example, or if you're making a pasta or an omelet or one of those scrambled eggs with asparagus or something like that, I use the thin asparagus for that.
Okay, let's talk with a listener, a caller in Burlington on line 4. You're on the air with Russ Parsons. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I was wondering if your guest could explain how to handle a mango. It has that large seed, and when you peel it, it gets very slippery, and I wondered what he would recommend on preparation.
You know, somebody's actually put out a gadget for seeding mangoes. I haven't bought it. Mangoes are kind of tricky. The way that you do a mango is it's got that large center seed that's flat. Mm-hmm. And so use a sharp knife and then cut parallel to the seed on one side, and then cut parallel to the seed on the other side. You'll have these two pieces with the peel attached to it. You can do just like a little crosshatch that goes to the peel but not through the peel, and then you just kind of pop it out, and you can just slice nice little chunks of mango out. But a good mango is a really, really terrific piece of fruit.
Yes, it sure is. I was wondering, is mango grown anywhere in the United States, in Hawaii?
It is grown in Hawaii, and there is some mango that they're trying to grow in California, with mixed success. Most of the mangoes that we get are imported.
Yeah, and I understand that the United States is going to allow Indian mangoes into
this year
the country.
For the first time.
Yeah, and there's a lot of excitement among mango fans.
Yeah, you know, we have a choice of it's like tomatoes used to be. We have a choice of two or three different kinds of mangoes, usually in a summertime. But there's a whole world of mangoes with all different kinds of flavors and textures out there. And so I'm really looking forward to seeing how these Indian mangoes do.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's a real cult of mango lovers, people who have traveled. I haven't traveled to India, but people who have, you know, insist that this is like, you know, that the mangoes that they get there are so far better than the ones that we usually get here.
Yeah, and I want to hold on to our Burlington caller if she's still there, and I want to hold on to our guest, Russ Parsons. I got to interrupt one more time here for a severe thunderstorm warning. The National Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for northeastern Sangamon, northern Macon, DeWitt County, and southeastern Logan County in central Illinois until 2:15. At 1:29, National Weather Service Doppler radar indicated a severe thunderstorm. The storm located 5 miles northwest of Iliopolis, or about 17 miles south of Lincoln, and moving northeast at 40 miles per hour. Stay tuned to WILL AM and FM for the latest on the weather. Okay, and we're back with Russ Parsons. And is our caller from Burlington still there?
Yes, I am. And I had another question, and that's about the kiwi. And what is the best tool to use to peel a kiwi?
I use a sharp paring knife, just a small sharp paring knife. And it just, you know, it's like cutting the peel off of an orange, kind of, where you cut the top and bottom off and prop the kiwi up on that flat side, and then just follow follow the line of the kiwi. The peel is very thin,
yes.
kind of fuzzy. I think in France they call it mouse fruit.
Okay, well, very, very good. Thank you very much. As far as storing kiwi and mango, can they be stored in the refrigerator for any length of time?
Yeah, they should. You shouldn't store them in the refrigerator until they're ripe. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a mistake a lot of people make, is kind of automatically sticking everything in the refrigerator. With the refrigerator really slows down the ripening process, and the mango is one of those fruits that will continue to ripen after it's been picked. So you need to, you know, just set it out on a plate at room temperature until it becomes really fragrant and starts to soften. Then you can stick it in the fridge.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. How do you choose a mango?
With mangoes, it's a little bit like a pear, you know, where it starts to soften a little bit,
uh-huh.
or like a peach. But if you've ever had a really ripe mango, there's no question, because I mean the smell is just intoxicating. I think probably the best comparison is a peach. You know how when you get a great fresh peach, you can smell it all the way across the produce department, and it's the same. thing with mangoes.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Russ Parsons, our guest this afternoon in this portion of the program. He's the author, most recently, of How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments about fruits and vegetables. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL. 800-222-WILL. Something that I've noticed in the supermarket recently is they're doing more to more accurately label fruits and vegetables. For example, you write about melons in How to Pick a Peach, mm-hmm. and we used to call this particular fruit a cantaloupe, and it turns out that's not really accurate. And in the grocery store now, recently, I've seen them try to take a stab at labeling these things more accurately.
Buck melons.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are a lot of common geographical names. In the Midwest, they do call cantaloupes or muskmelons cantaloupes. There's a difference, like a true cantaloupe, you know, like a muskmelon has netting, has that kind of netting on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
A true cantaloupe has these deep ribs, too, in addition to the netting. And I think that's just a sign of people getting more and more sophisticated in their shopping.
Yeah. The other day, I picked up, I think it was 2 days ago, I picked up a melon labeled Tuscan, and it has the netting and the ribs.
So that's a true cantaloupe. The Latin name for it is cantalupensis. And there's a whole family of them. There's another one. There's an Israeli variety called the Ha'ogan, and that's a good one too.
Yeah, and then I'm really looking forward to getting into this. I'm going to have it tonight with some prosciutto. Can I expect it to taste different than the muskmelon I'm used to?
If it's a good one, it should taste just a little bit more like it. A good cantalupensis melon is a little bit more flowery than a muskmelon, but it'll be about the same.
Oh, okay. And
how did you choose that melon? That's the good question there.
I sniffed it.
That's always a good thing to do. I mean, melons have, especially netted melons, the cantalupensis and also the muskmelons, their fragrance really announces when they're ripe.
Yeah, and I looked at it, and I didn't want to see any bad spot or sign of deterioration.
Right.
And then
and check the belly button.
Yeah.
Check the belly button, because the belly button should be clean, because these melons, when they're ripe, they separate naturally from the vine. They just fall off of the vine. So if there's any stem left in there, that means it was probably picked before
too,
it was ripe.
Too soon. Okay.
The other thing to look for with those things is, you know, that the netting should be raised. And the background color of it, not the netting color, but the background color should be golden instead of green.
Hmm.
The really tricky ones are the honeydews, because there's no smell involved.
Yeah.
In fact, the Latin name for the honeydew family is inodorous, meaning it has no odor. But with honeydews, you can tell a little bit by looking at the pale spot that's on the bottom of the melon where it rested on the ground. It should be a deep, creamy color. And also, sometimes, if you're lucky and you've got a lazy produce manager, if you feel the melon, it'll be sticky, or there will be little brown spots on it. And that's because of these melons, when they get really ripe, the sugar actually breaks through the rind. Now, really ambitious produce managers usually think that that's a flaw, and so they'll wipe it off, and they'll clean the melons. But every once in a while at the supermarket, you'll find one that's like that. That's going to be a great melon.
Yeah. Well, I was happy to read in your book that we're doing the right thing in terms of storing them. You know, don't let them go overripe on you, because they continue to ripen.
Right.
And then if you want it a cool or cold, just put it in to the refrigerator for a brief period of time. But don't
after it's been ripened.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, with peaches, that's really, really important. I mean, everybody knows that you should never put a tomato in the refrigerator, no matter what, right?
Right.
But with peaches, if you put an underripe peach in the refrigerator, it develops what they call chill damage, and they can't really explain exactly what happens. But if you've ever had a peach that was kind of and it was dry and mealy, and it didn't have any flavor. That had probably been chilled someplace along the line, whether you did it or the grocery store did it or the shipping company did it. It was chilled before it became ripe. Mm. Once they're ripe, you can go ahead and stick them in the refrigerator. And there's no magic to ripening them. It's just a matter of you put them on a plate and leave them at room temperature in a shady spot for a day or two, and they'll ripen up real easily.
Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener in Danville, line 4. Hi.
Hi. I'd like to know how to pick an eggplant, particularly the scar on the blossom end, which is male, which is female.
Well, you know, I don't know who started that, but I've seen that written so many times. But there is no such thing as a male or a female eggplant. All eggplants are fruits, and so they don't have a gender.
Well, but the flowers are dioecious then?
Yes.
Okay. But there are different. I mean, sometimes you get a round one, sometimes you get an oblong one, and I.
Right, and there's a difference in variety, but not in the.
It doesn't have anything to do with the number of seeds inside.
No, and you know, if people say that I actually talk about this quite a bit in the book, but people say that it's the seeds that make eggplant bitter. But what really makes eggplant bitter is when it's too old, and when eggplant gets too old, the seeds become much more apparent because the flesh begins to pull away from the seeds, and so you see them much more easily.
Yeah, I really haven't had a bitter eggplant for years and years, but 50 years ago they used to tell you to slice it and then sprinkle it with salt and weight it down on a plate and let all that dark, gooey stuff.
yeah. And that's still really good advice, especially if you're going to fry the eggplant. Because that kind of collapses the cells. The salt draws the moisture out, and it collapses the cells. And so when you fry it, then it absorbs some of the oil, which, you know, you may or may not want, but it is delicious. And that's when you get eggplant that has that really nice, creamy texture. I did, like, side-by-side comparisons, and it doesn't do anything for eggplant that you're grilling. But it does work really well for eggplant that you're frying.
Oh, well, I hadn't heard that salt thing for so many years. I just thought that it wasn't valid anymore.
It's still valid, but probably not for the reason. They used to say that removed the bitterness. And the water that's pulled out is bitter, but the eggplant, if it's a bitter eggplant, it will still be bitter.
Well, I'm sure, too, that there's so many new varieties that have been on the market since 50 years ago.
Yeah. And the way that you choose an eggplant, remember, the funny thing about eggplant is that it's a tropical fruit. And so you want to be real careful about refrigerating them because they develop very quickly. They develop those soft spots. That's chill damage. And what you want from an eggplant is you want it to be really heavy for its size, mm-hmm. and you want the skin to be really, really taut. It should feel, when you pick up a good eggplant, it should feel almost like it's getting ready to burst out of the skin.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, the last 2 months in the trips to the grocery store, I haven't found an eggplant like that, so I haven't bought
any. Well, you're probably not going to, because eggplants are really a late summer specialty.
Yeah.
So that, when they're going to be at their best is like August, September, into early October.
Oh, good enough. Well, thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for the call.
333-9455, 800-222-9455. If you'd like to talk with Russ Parsons, author of How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. We're talking about fruits and vegetables here this afternoon on The Afternoon Magazine. One of the things you remark on early in the book is how you made the selections you did. And I said to my husband last night, I said, yes. You said one of the things that you did is you have to include the tomato, you have to do strawberry, but you left some things out because, for example, the apricot.
Right.
The apricot.
It's a great tragedy.
What happened?
Well, apricots are great fruits, but they can be. And in California, we're still lucky. We've got some old, 100-year-old trees that are still producing this old variety called the Royal Blenheim. But so much of the apricot, it's the Royal Blenheim, the apricots tend to be small. They tend to come on all at once. They've got all these problems. So the farmers were looking for alternatives. And at the same time, so much of apricot of the harvest went to canning or to drying. So they started using more varieties that were better suited for that. So fresh apricots just kind of went by the wayside.
And they're so expensive.
Yes. Yeah, and they don't, you know. So I didn't include them in the book because I didn't feel like it was a nice thing to do to say, well, if you can get this one great apricot, then you can cook with apricots, but otherwise forget about it. You're better off buying just dried apricots.
Yeah. Now, there are a couple of different varieties of dried apricots. Do you have a preference?
Yeah, the Blenheim.
Okay.
And you'll find them labeled that way.
Blenheim, okay.
And it's like the castle in England, Blenheim.
Okay, good. Because the thing I'm thinking of now is they either come labeled, at least the label that screams out at you, California or Mediterranean.
Yeah, and they still, there are good apricots that come out of Turkey, too.
Oh, yeah, right, okay. Very, very interesting. What do you think of the jarred, in the produce department now, we have jars of fruits, and there are apricots there. What do you think of those products?
Some of them could be pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
If they use, because that's essentially just it's canned, but it's in a jar. It goes through the same process, and it's in a sugar syrup.
Mm-hmm.
If the sugar syrup isn't too heavy, that can be really good. But what I find so often is that they use a really high concentration of sugar in the syrup, and so they become kind of sticky sweet. They don't.
Yeah.
The fruit flavor doesn't come through.
Yeah.
And in fact, in the book, I make my own fruit salads, and it's really simple. Just, you know, I use half as much sugar by volume as water. Boil it till it's clear, and then you can make a tea like with basil or with chamomile or any of these other things. And it makes a really nice light sauce.
Sounds good. I'm ready to go home and get in the kitchen.
I've done my job.
Let's do one more call. Listener in Sullivan, line 4. Hi.
Hello. Hey, I had a comment about two things, the kiwi and the mango.
Mm-hmm.
You ask if anyone grew mango in the United States, somebody asked. They do grow mango in Texas. I don't know if it's grown commercially or not.
Oh, in South Texas?
But I do know it's grown there.
Oh, great. Well, now, I remember part of my mom's family is from Indiana, and they used to call bell peppers mangoes.
Yes.
They do that in
yeah.
Illinois?
Uh-huh. But in down in Texas, they do grow mangoes. My sister-in-law used to live down there, and when she'd come to visit us, she'd bring us some really good mangoes.
Oh, that's a good sister.
And they were a lot bigger than the ones you buy here in the store.
Uh-huh.
They're about twice the size of the ones you buy here in Central Illinois in the store.
Yeah, it's a tropical fruit, and so it takes it needs heat and it needs humidity.
Yeah.
And that certainly sounds like South Texas.
Yeah, that's where she was at. And as far as somebody asked about peeling kiwi.
Uh-huh.
When I eat kiwi, I don't peel them.
Do you just spoon it out?
I take a teaspoon. Take a good quality teaspoon, because not the cheap stainless steel ones. One of them has a fine edge on it, and you just scoop it right out, cut it in half, and scoop it out.
Like you'd eat a hard-boiled egg or something.
Yeah.
Or a soft-boiled egg.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good... That's
you have to be really right to do that, but it works real good for me. That's all I had to say, but I thought you might know about the mangoes. They do grow them in Texas. Now, I'm not sure if they're grown commercially or not, but I know she used to bring us some really nice ones.
Well, I'll keep my eye out for them. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for the call this afternoon. Russ Parsons, we've got to stop now. We're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon and for your patience with the weather.
Oh, of course. I understand about weather, believe me.
Yeah. Speaking of Texas, okay.
Yeah.
Russ Parsons, thank you so much.
And thanks for having me on. It was great talking to you.
It was so good to talk with you. And this book, I really highly recommend it. It's a very fun read. It's very educational, but it's, you know, it's not like eating your spinach. Pardon me. Pardon
you.
Me. But it's great.
Although
fun.
There's spinach in there.
Yes, there are greens in there. How to Pick a Peach: The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. The publisher, Houghton Mifflin.